Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality, and is about discovering your place in this great universe, from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life, and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show, Alternative Medicine and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we are going to be talking about our soul, our spirit, our resilience, and how we make it through life. We're going to be taking it from a totally different aspect. Today, my guest is Michaela Haas, who is the co-author of a newly released Coco Chiman, The Ghetto Swinger, a Jazz Legend Remembers book. And she has known Mr. Chiman for more than 20 years. When she met him, he asked her to co-author his autobiography. The book we are talking about today is The Ghetto Swinger, a Jazz Legend Remembers, which is the autobiography of Coco Chiman, which chronicles the incredible life of a man considered the best jazz musician of his time. The legendary jazz musician was forced to entertain Nazis and serenade Jews as they were marched to the gas chambers. However, Chiman does not want to be labeled a Holocaust survivor, but as living proof of the ultimate beauty and power of music. So, Michaela, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michaela, what do you think? Is it just the process? Is it just getting through? I think we don't really have any choices, humans. We can't sit down and say, I quit, right?
Well, what fascinates me, and I think Coco Schumann's story has a lot of power, and I've gained a lot of inspiration from his example, because when you think about how horrible the experience of Auschwitz was,
right,
and yet, you know, Viktor Frankl, another Holocaust survivor, said that even in the midst of horror, we still have the last of the human freedoms, and that is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And this is really what Coco did. And despite the horrible surrounding, I think it was the music that kept him going. It was the music that literally saved his life. So, yes, as you said, that was his core. That was his passion. And that was what got him through this horrible experience.
And I think that society has done a very good job of telling people that some events are going to break you and then that's going to be it. When really we as souls forget that we can keep going. And I think this is definitely a good example of we can keep going, you know, and to start leaving some things behind. You know, they may have an imprint on your life, but they don't have control over your life.
That's such an important point, because I think all the survivors who managed to rebuild their lives after the horrible experiences they went through, they recognize that element of taking control, which is so important. And I've researched Coco's life story, but also I've researched the signs of resilience and post-traumatic growth. And most people don't know that there even is such a thing as post-traumatic growth, that there is actually a science that helps us to get through experiences like that, and that helps us figure out methods and support how we can not only survive but thrive in the face of such challenges. And Coco, I think, is a prime example of that. And when you meet him, he's now 91. He lives in Berlin, and he is such a joyful person. It was really his optimism, his resilience, his belief in life that kept him going. And one of the things that surprised me most in my research was that Holocaust survivors are actually more optimistic. They have a more positive outlook on life than their peers mm-hmm. who have not experienced the Holocaust. Isn't that amazing? You would think that people who've seen the worst would have a more pessimistic outlook, but they don't. And I think that's part of the inspiration that Coco translates.
And I think that goes back to what I had just said previously, because it doesn't take you down. You are a spirit that keeps going forward. So they have seen how it could potentially take them right to the end. It took them to the edge of the cliff. And they said, okay, if I'm going over, I'm going over. But if I'm not, I still have a life to live. And I think that's what he said, is I still have a life to live. And he just kept going on.
He says, listen, I could have spent the rest of my life being devastated about what I saw in Auschwitz, or I could live the rest of my life with the joy that I survived, and I choose the latter. But Coco, I mean, he was taken down, and he almost didn't survive because he was deported to Auschwitz when he was only, to Theresienstadt first, when he was only 19 years old. So he was a kid. He was a teenager. And when he first got to Theresienstadt, it was the time when, it was in 1943, when Theresienstadt was not yet a death camp. And Hitler tried to show off Theresienstadt as a kind of summer camp for Jews. And when Coco got there on his first day, he discovered a coffee house in the ghetto. And there was a band playing called the Ghetto Swingers, which is what gave the book its name, Coco Schumann, the Ghetto Swinger. And because he was such a great musician, they invited him to join, and they played every day. And in one of the most cynical pieces of Nazi propaganda, Hitler wanted to make a movie about how well the Jews lived in Theresienstadt. So he gave all the musicians new suits, and they were to play upbeat music to show the world that that Germany was treating the Jews well. And of course, it was all a big lie. And the musicians were promised that as soon as the film was finished, they would be released into freedom. And of course, that did not happen. They were all deported to Auschwitz, and only three of the 16 musicians survived, and Coco was one of them. But even in Auschwitz, he played almost every day. Even in Auschwitz, the camp leaders competed for the best bands. And because Coco was such a great musician, he got extra rations of food, he got extra clothes, they let him choose good boots, which was actually essential for survival in the Polish winter. And this is how he survived.
And has he explained to you what it felt like when he had to play, you know, at Auschwitz? Because somewhere in your core, you must have a concept that this is maybe not a good thing, or did he just keep himself at a level where he just was paying attention to what his music was and kind of let those events go around him? Obviously, he explains it very clearly in the book about the smell, the senses, he could hear, all of his senses were very acute about what was going on around him, yet he was still able to keep going forward.
I think one thing to know is that Coco didn't speak about Auschwitz for more than 40 years. He couldn't. It was too horrible. And I think if he could have forgotten, he would have liked to forget what he experienced. And there is no sweet-talking that. Of course, the music helped him.
Right.
But he had to play upbeat entertainment songs while he watched children marching to the gas chamber, and he said he knew exactly what was going on, and the children knew exactly what was going on. And he said, we didn't look away. I looked into their eyes, and they looked into my eyes while I played La Paloma and other entertaining tunes. So how bizarre is that? And he said, I prayed to every God there is. I prayed and prayed and prayed, and nobody came to help. So it took him... It took him decades to be able to talk about that. After he was released, and at the end he almost didn't make it, after he was released, he would just say, I was in Theresienstadt and Auschwitz, and he would leave it at that. He was unable to talk about it. until shortly before I met him more than 20 years ago. When he had an experience, he was in Bavaria, and I lived and worked in Munich at the time. And he had spent an evening at a restaurant, and next to him was a table of young people, and they got drunk, and they were talking about how the Holocaust never happened, how it was all a big lie. And then he got up, and he said, "I know it happened. I was there." And then he knew he had to tell his story. But it was hard. It was hard for him to put in words these things that are really so unimaginable that there are no words for them. And he says to this day there are things that he does not speak about because he can't.
And I think sometimes it's just, for him, his peace is just letting them be at peace and letting it at rest. You know, sometimes when you go back and you discuss a lot of that past, there are some you do for a purpose to be able to share the story. But
yes,
there's some also that you just don't, you need to leave it, be at peace and be at rest. And, you know, thinking about this when you mentioned it being 20 years, it's so interesting. I have another dear friend. This person that I had met, I was going out with someone in the early 70s, and his father was also there at Auschwitz. And I had not known that at this that time. In fact, I only found out about it in the past 2 years. 20 years ago, he just started to talk about his experiences also. And he is also in his 90s. So I wonder energetically out there what has changed where people are ready to release that story. Do you know what I mean? In other words, there had to have been something that just came up, and I think maybe that they're getting older. They felt it was time, that the world was maybe ready for their story. And I think, again, you know, the book now is very, the world can be ready to hear that.
Well, I think these stories are testimonies. And also they, as I said earlier, they these stories carry a power but also a responsibility for us to not ever let anything like this happen again. And for Coco, clearly this encounter with people who denied the Holocaust, that was what changed his stance. But also I think the traumas that we don't speak about, the hidden traumas that we carry with us, they hold so much more power over us than the traumas that we are able to verbalize. And one of the, I think, key strategies for healing from trauma is to be able to share it with others and to put it in words. I think that's crucial because it releases some of the energy that's bottled up when we keep it to ourselves. So Coco's wife was also a Theresienstadt survivor. So I do hope that at least between the two of them, they were able to talk openly about what they've experienced. But I don't know that for sure that he did that. But I think releasing some of the trauma in words is really important.
Yeah, because it really does eat a hole in your being.
Yes.
And it, you know, and when it does that, many get very ill from that physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually. And that part of you, you want to say, I'm now ready and able to look at that and give it less power. You know, on this show, many times we've said, what I do on the show is I try to bring up topics and conversations, and I might say something in the shows that what I call is a, you know, a rock turner. We're going to turn over all of the rocks because when you give it light, it no longer has the power to be hidden.
Yes.
So many times, you know, we just have to do that because, you know, working, I think I learned this so very clearly in the past few decades, is working with clients at the end of life also. They really want to start sharing very rapidly when they know they're close to death because they know that they want to share it out. However, sometimes it comes out as spewed and it doesn't, it comes out as disempowering instead of empowering. So really what he has done, he has empowered himself and others to do it versus the opposite of just, you know, hey, I'm going to purge this now because I don't know if God's going to be happy with me, so I'm going to let it out. And I think many people carry that with them to their deathbed. And I think I've seen that so many times when people are filling out their their do not resuscitate in their advanced directive forms is they're more scared to see God than they are to be able to say what holds them back. Hmm. And I think that is a very difficult place to be, you know. But, you know, our demons are only as big as we give them the light to be, right?
Yes, and I think Cuckoo was struggling with these demons. And also I think one reason why he didn't talk about his experiences in the Holocaust sooner is that right after the war ended, he didn't necessarily feel safe in Germany. You know, he saw some of the old Nazis scramble back to power, and he actually left for a while. He went to Australia for several years, and he became famous there, and then he went on cruise ships for several years working there. So, but then still, Germany was his home, so he kept coming back, and he kept fleeing, I think also fleeing from his own memories and from his own experiences. So it definitely was a struggle. It definitely was not easy, for sure. But to come to that point where he was able to speak about what he saw and what he went through, I think I'm very grateful that he finally found it important to tell his story. And it's just such an amazing story. I mean, most people don't even know that there were bands in the death camp in Auschwitz. There was music, there was jazz, there was swing, there was blues, there was all kinds of music that was outlawed in the rest of Germany. And I was fascinated by all the stories he told, you know, that he lived through, both during the Holocaust and then afterwards when he came back to Berlin, which was completely bombed, of course. And he had lost almost all his family, his grandparents, his aunts, his uncles. But much to his amazement, he found his parents alive. And his mother was Jewish. His father was Christian.
Right.
And his father had managed to keep his wife alive by declaring her dead after a fire. So that alone is an unbelievable act of courage, that his father stayed by his wife and managed to keep her alive throughout the Second World War.
Because Coco also said in the book, too, that, you know, why didn't his father stand up for the German part, you know, and he wanted to, you know, resonate with the German part more instead of, you know, his mother's part, too. And it's, you know, and that, but really, his parents really stood up together as a unified source, you know, and really showed him the strength of both sides, I think, versus, you know, well, we're going to go this way because we're afraid of the other way, you know, or so in other words, they all went through this together. It was, they all stuck together. Their beings said, we're going to get through this. And they did.
Well, his father actually saved his life because, Coco was turned in for being Jewish. He didn't wear the yellow star that he was supposed to wear. He kept it in his pocket.
Right.
Because he was blonde and blue-eyed, he got away with a lot. So he was Jewish. He was playing jazz and swing, which was verboten, which was outlawed. And he also got reported for seducing German girls. He was very handsome and very charming. And so at 19, they wanted to deport him to Auschwitz, not to Theresienstadt. It was actually his father who rushed to the train station and who argued with the guy in charge. And his father was a decorated veteran from the First World War. And so he showed off his you know, his merits, and he managed to at least detour Coco so that Coco would get to Theresienstadt instead of Auschwitz. So that definitely saved his life. And that he was able to go to Theresienstadt first, which was not yet a death camp, and only later he was deported to Auschwitz. I think that without his father intervening on his behalf at that time, we would not know his story at all.
Yes, because in the book it also said, you know, where his father had says, I'm not going to abandon my family.
Yes.
And that was so very important to be able to know that.
Yes. Because a lot of guys did.
You know, not only that, I mean, look at nowadays. I mean, my goodness. You know, men and women break up marriages just because someone looks the wrong way or because they didn't pay the bills enough or for all of these simplistic reasons these days. And you look at it in comparison and you go, what the heck are we complaining about these days, you know? I think we have, you know, if we look at people now, we really say, you really don't understand. And I think probably that's why this story is also very important, is how the elders have really stood up for what they did in their life. They really had values. They had principles. They stuck to things. They believed in each other. They had to be stable. They had to know they had someone to be supporting them. They knew they had to depend on somebody or something at all costs. Nowadays, it's sort of like, oh, you know, whoever, if I get enough likes on my page, otherwise you're gone. Yeah. You know, and it's so silly stuff. And we think, my goodness, why have we really come this way as humans? And I think that's why this book, I mean, I could almost say this book is being in a high school and saying, how petty can you be? I think you need to revisit your thoughts and read something about the, you know, how life is.
And focus on what's important, and standing by your family member or by your friend is crucial. And it's one of the main factors of resilience and post-traumatic growth, because his father risked his own life by standing by his family. And many people chose to abandon their Jewish family members or to get a divorce in a hurry so that their own lives could be spared. And his father chose not to do that. And also, after the Holocaust, it was really the community for Coco. It was his family, but also his community of bandmates that gave him strength. And one of the things that I've heard again and again from Holocaust survivors is the bond they have with each other and with other survivors. And the divorce rate among Holocaust survivors is almost zero because once you've been through something so severe and you've made it through that, or you've rebuilt your life after the Holocaust together, you don't let go of each other easily. You stick by the other one's side, and that's also something, you're absolutely right. I think so often we let go too soon, and having one person, at least one person that stands by us and who loves us no matter what, that's we can't do it without that.
And I think also when we look at the soldiers that come back from war, I think they do have that. However, they have not reached the point where they're able to speak about their experiences yet. I mean, it is really difficult to know that this could, human beings could hurt another human being. And for such, I think I will call tender souls, being, you know, soldiers or Coco and the other people and all of this generation, all of these people who are out there really sticking their neck out in life and having these experiences as tender souls, because they know that it is not, that's not how human beings treat human beings. They know that it's just, it isn't correct. They know that there has to be something off, that something is, it's almost like you could close your eyes and wonder what kind of horror is going on the movie screen, right?
Yes, exactly. You're right, absolutely. But also, I think, you know, that's our responsibility as families, as communities, as a country, as a culture, to stand by the people who come back from war, whether it was 50 years ago or today, and to show them solidarity and to show that we're there for them and that we're not afraid to have these conversations. Because, of course, in the 50s, when Coco came out of Auschwitz, you know, the term PTSD or post-traumatic stress wasn't even there. There wasn't even really a vocabulary to talk about it. It was just pull yourself up by the bootstraps and, you know, rebuild your life. And it's only now that we have more of a vocabulary for that, and then we know so much more about what helps people cope with such experiences.
Or also, too, maybe coming around full circle, we know what it takes to be able to get through it. Because, you know, it's so easy to tell somebody to do something if you've never done it yourself. But it's even harder, you know, to be able to go through it if you don't have any way to be able to resolve it yourself.
Yes. Yes, I think that's where communities come in and groups of survivors to forge this bond, because in all of the research on resilience and post-traumatic growth and for the Holocaust survivors, it really, really shows that the solidarity is the most important for them to be able to go on living.
Yes, and as I said, my friend that started to speak out just a few years ago, he did put it all on video, and it is online, because he is now not doing well, and he just had to get it out. He never, ever spoke about it. In fact, I can remember in the 70s, I was over at his house, and he was on vacation, and he came back, and I had put up a Christmas tree because I'm Roman Catholic, in their living room, and it was like the first tree that they've ever seen, you know. And he came back, and he was like so livid about taking that tree down. Yet I couldn't understand, and I thought he was just mad at me that he had never let. In other words, he was always an angry man to certain circumstances and people. But what was really happening was is that he had not shared his core. He hadn't shared his real deep feelings about his life. He hadn't shared what he had been through. Even his children did not know all of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that sometimes we like to put a great face on. We need to say everything is okay. I'll tell you, there's two words. I mean, the one word I really want out of people's vocabulary is I am fine. When that's no one is fine. No, okay, I'm sorry. 100% flat out, no one is fine all the time. You know, but we're so quick to say that because we don't want to let anybody see the cracks in us.
That's a cultural expectation.
Right, and the cracks in us is exactly where we're waiting for someone to touch us or reach us, but we keep saying, I'm fine. It's sort of like, well, go ahead, keep saying that. You're not going to get anywhere.
Yes. Yeah, I think this is so important, and I have the exact same experience with my grandparents, because I learned one of my grandfathers was in the Second World War. He never spoke about it, and I only learned some of what he's been through at his funeral when his former comrades spoke about what they've experienced in the Second World War, and I didn't know any of that. He never talked about that, and so I think it's also, you know, it's a generation, and times are changing, where I feel it is okay to speak about what you're not okay with and what you're struggling with. And that's one of the main reasons why I write about post-traumatic growth, because it's not saying I'm fine. It's about tending to the wound and addressing your true feelings. And even, for instance, I went to the resilience boot camp of the U.S. Army, and even there, they're teaching the soldiers now to admit weaknesses, speak about their fears, and not to regard it as a weakness, to reach out and ask for help, because the Army has recognized that it's fatal to project that image only strength. Nobody is only strong. And to expect that soldiers go through fire and somehow come out unscathed is unrealistic, and it's literally fatal.
Yeah. You know, so many times I have worked with people, and they would say to me something, and then I would say, okay, well, how does that make you feel? And they would say, oh, well, I'm really pissed. I said, no, you're not. And then they would get really mad and angry. And I said, oh, hallelujah, finally we're getting somewhere. And they're like, what? And it would be like, because you're now letting those things go out, you know? So, you know, it just has to release somewhere. And, when Coco says in his book about jazz is not a dictatorship, I want to make sure I have the exact words, but where he says, I could endure it when they play classical music, but with swing, it was no go. Jazz does not allow for a dictatorship. I think right there, jazz does not allow for a dictatorship. It's exactly what has kept him alive all of these times, because he was saying he couldn't be squashed in, he couldn't be pent in, he couldn't be changed or molded into something else. He couldn't be a follower, he couldn't be a hurtful person, he couldn't be, those people who are going to be down on others. He really showed himself by saying that, and I really think that is the most powerful sentence in the entire book.
Wow, yeah. Yes, I think there's a lot to it. I think there's a reason why the Nazis singled out jazz and other forms of black art as the enemy, as the most, as the music and the art they outlawed. And it didn't just have to do with the skin color. I think it had to do with, as Coco says, you just can't march lockstep to jazz. It's just the music itself is vibrant and creative, and it just doesn't go well with a dictatorship.
Yeah, because, you know, you just can't be squashed into things. You can't be. He says, my soul will not, I feel, he is saying that his soul cannot be had. And he kept his soul in his music, and I think that's really what you feel when you hear it. Can you share a little bit about the Barnyard Porter? Because I think that was, he wrote quite a bit about that in his book, too.
Share about? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
The Barnyard Quarter.
The Barnyard Quarter.
Yes, about you know, about how the salons and everything were there, and how he would go there, and it was a safe place, and it wasn't a safe place. And in the beginning, he would talk about you know, that's where his music was, where he would play, and where all of the other musicians, he could find them there. You know, it was a place where really, I think, where he got his first sense of a lively soul or a lively spirit.
Oh, you mean before before he was deported?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, Coco...
Way in the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course. Well, Coco really fell in love with music when he was 12 years old. And he was, of course, too young to be allowed into the bars and the theaters. So he would stand outside and try to hear as much as he could from the music. And so when he was 13, he got his first drum kit. His uncle gave him his first drum kit, and he would play for a few Reichsmark at the time until he had enough money to finally get a guitar. And that's how he, you know, what he was really famous for is his guitar playing. And so just before the World War II, it was such a lively music scene. And I think everybody had some sense of the impending danger and doom that was about to come. And so they partied extra hard. And they enjoyed life to the fullest, because I think they had an inkling that it wouldn't last. And so even when the Nazis had already taken over, Coco would play in bars as a 16-year-old, and they had spies at the doors who would tell them when the Gestapo would approach, and then they would switch from the illegal music, the jazz and the swing, to some, you know, kitsch that the Nazis liked. They would change their tune. But until 1943, he really had a great time in the entertainment scene, which is amazing because, you know, that was 10 years into the Nazi regime, and that he was even able to stay out of the death camps for so long that he got away with his subterfuge, that he got away with playing in bars as an underage minor for so long is a miracle in itself. And at one point, when the Gestapo came into the Rosita bar where he was playing, he actually told them, he said, you know, you have at least three reasons to arrest me. I'm a Jew, I'm a minor, and I'm playing swing. And there was this moment of silence in the bar, and then the SS man broke into laughter, and the whole bar roared. And they thought it was a joke. And that was his hiding place. His hiding place was the limelight.
Right. And that's definitely, you know, he was so protected. And he speaks often of his guardian angel in the book, you know, and he believes that that was a guardian angel also. And there were other times. Can you share what his thought was on the guardian angels when he spoke with you?
Well, Coco isn't religious in a traditional sense, but he says, I must have had a guardian angel because there were so many moments and situations when I could have lost my life, and that I survived all of this is a miracle. So someone was guiding me. So the interesting thing is that Coco didn't really feel Jewish, you know, when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. His family wasn't very religious, and he only realized that he was Jewish when all of a sudden the Nazis took over and he couldn't do certain things that his classmates could do. He wanted to join the Hitler Youth because he didn't know any different until his school teacher said, oh, no, you can't join. And so he, right. At some point he said, well, you know, if you want to hammer the Jewishness into me, all right, then I'll be Jewish. But he never practiced it in the traditional sense. And when he was in Auschwitz and he prayed, he said, I pray to all the gods, whoever is up there, the mm-hmm. Jewish God, Jesus Christ, Buddha, Allah, just somebody please come and help us. And he's kept that, mm-hmm. I would call it an open-minded faith throughout all his life.
Yeah, I think almost when you think of angels or guardian angels, I just think of it as protection. In other words, there's that sense of intuition that says, whoa. It's almost a sense of, you can almost feel an energy come over you that's holding you back or pushing you forward, whatever you need at that moment. Yes. And sometimes I think if we are really akin to that and listen to that, we're able to say, whoa, I know that's not me. And I will just take it for what it is and accept it. And I think that's really what he's been able to do. And yes. Also, when you said about the Jewish, you know, about, you know, if you want to push it into me, he's also saying again, as he said through the book over and over, about it, it was another label. He mm-hmm. wasn't ready to be that label. He wasn't German. He wasn't Jewish. He wasn't this. He wasn't that. He was just the music. That's all he was. And
well, he calls himself
not collecting them.
He calls himself a misfit, proudly.
Yes.
You know, because
yes.
He didn't really exactly fit in anywhere. He was his own person,
yeah.
And he still is. And that's what makes Coco
yeah.
Coco. It's his, he's unique. And he never let anybody tell him what to do, really. And that he defied the law by not wearing the yellow star
mm-hmm.
for so many years. That, you know, he was so defiant. That's, I think in the end, that's what saved his life, that he did not give up and he did not give in. He was his own person. He is his own person. And so, yes, I mean, the guardian angel, you know, he had such close calls with death. I mean, at one point, mm-hmm. One of his friends in Auschwitz came running into the sick bay where he was at the time. He said, you have to get out immediately. They're going to empty the whole sick bay, and they're going to kill everybody. And so mm-hmm. he got out, and 10 minutes later, they took everybody away and put them in the gas chamber. So he was literally 10 minutes away from death. Or when
mm-hmm.
finally Auschwitz was freed, he was so ill, he had finally gotten the dreaded spotted fever. He almost died from that, and there were only he and one other man, who survived the sick bay after catching the spotted fever at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, or even when he got to Auschwitz, you know, the selection ramp, one of his bandmates, Fritig Weiss, opted to join his elderly parents. And Coco he actually met Joseph Mengele in Auschwitz, and he looked him straight in the eye and he said, I'm young, I can work, I'm a plumber. And so he was selected to join the group of people who were not sent to the gas chamber immediately upon arrival. So it was luck, but it was also, I think, an inner guidance that he had. He did do
mm-hmm.
and say the right thing at the right time.
And again, too, now he's still doing that, is saving people at the right time, because now he's sharing the stories that if anyone had had grandparents that may have been involved in this or any experienced this, they are now able to read the book, The Ghetto Swinger, and they will say, my gosh, I never knew that. Or if there is anyone alive right now, they're able to say, you know, probably reading it, that it releases something in them also, and I really think that's important. And, you know, what struck the daylights out of me when I was reading this book is the time frame. It was in the, you know, 30s and 40s, and I go, gosh, I was born in the 50s. It was so close. Mm-hmm. And I did not, but you know what I mean? You and I sitting here, we're going, how close we were to those years. Well, what was going on in America, and that was going on over there, and we're going, you know, it's just incredible to think about things going on differently in the world, you know, that so long ago not everybody knew, because there was no internet and everything else, you know. Really, you read what was somebody may have printed and hoped that it got passed in front of you. That's really how you knew about things. And, you know, now with these stories and books, information is shared at overwhelming volumes where people can say, wow, and it just keeps coming and coming and coming.
Yes. I mean, I consider it a great privilege that I was able to help Coco Schumann write and publish his life story, because I think there's so much to learn from his own example. It's a good book for people who are interested in jazz. After he survived Auschwitz, Coco played with jazz greats like Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong and Melina Dietrich. I mean, you name it. He played with a lot of the most famous musicians of his time. But also, I mean, for me personally, to know Coco is a privilege, and to be able to learn from him and to see his, you know, the famous book Unbroken, that's been on the bestseller list for so long. But Coco is another example of somebody who is unbroken, who they never managed to break him, despite all the horrors they put him through. And to know somebody like that lifts your own spirits. And I hope that people who read The Ghetto Swinger will be inspired by his example.
It is absolutely incredible. Can you share now about Coco's life, let's say in the last 10 years or so?
Well, he played until he was 90. he always kept joking, I'll quit when I get old.
How old is he now?
He's 91. The pain in his hands doesn't really allow him to play the guitar anymore, because when he plays, he wants it to be perfect. So he wouldn't go on stage unless he can do the gig well. But until a year and a half ago, he was playing. The clubs where he played were always sold out. And there's actually a musical about his life in Germany that's also always sold out. And it always gets standing ovations because his music is great. His life story is great. And he's a great person. So his life has not been easy after the war. You know, he had his share of illnesses. His wife passed away after a long struggle with Alzheimer's, so that was very painful for him, to losing her very slowly over many years. But again, still, it was the music that kept him going, and he played. He had his own quartet, the Coco Schumann Quartet, and that's, I think, the greatest joy in his life was to play with his band. And to, he says, sometimes people request the same songs that I had to play in Auschwitz, and I play them because I have at least one reason not to play them, but I have 1,000 reasons to play them, and that's every single person in the audience. And it's not the music's fault. It's not the music's fault.
And I believe he's probably still playing that music, but he's just not letting others know. And we, you know,
probably.
You know, it's what you do in your own home. Because there's something about it. And, you know, many times I would see people who were very old. My grandmother, she lived till she was 99. And still, even though she wasn't able to physically do something, you could still see her hands or her mind or her mouth move, you know. So in other words, they're still playing. It's still going on. It's just, you just don't see it on the place that you as a human would recognize being it on stage. He's playing it out every minute of his days. And I'm sure, you know, he will continue, you know. And that is the best testament, to be able to have a strong soul and just keep going forward.
Yes, exactly.
Well, my gosh, you know, we can talk forever, ever, Michaela. this is such a wonderful book. And could you share for our listeners how to find out more information about Coco and all of the venues? That would be wonderful.
So The Ghetto Swinger is available everywhere where books are sold. You can find it on Amazon or in your favorite bookstore. You can also go to my website, michaelahaas.com. I've also featured Coco's story in my latest book, Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs, which is a study of resilience and post-traumatic growth. And it's kind of the update to The Ghetto Swinger, because The Ghetto Swinger is Coco's life story, and Bouncing Forward goes deeper into, well, what is it that helps people through traumatic events? And, you can find Coco's music on iTunes and everywhere where you can find music. His music lives on and is available everywhere. So get the book, The Ghetto Swinger or Bouncing Forward. I have a video of Coco on my website, again, michaelahaas.com. And I think both his life story and the music are his legacy.
I sure thank you so much for bringing the story to us. I'm sure that there are many of our listeners that will say, this has turned over a rock for me. I don't know what it is or isn't, but I'm going to purchase the book and I'm going to be able to sit down. And maybe his story will be something that will resonate in you, the listeners, and you will say, I just felt something. I don't know what it is. I'm not related to the story, his story, however, something in the book has turned something in me to be able to release my story. And I really think that that's so vitally important. It's not always that things have to correlate with words. It has to be the feeling and emotions from, you know, from reading a book or sensing his music, where something in you will maybe release something so you can be able to just be able to be yourself, who you are, and stop hiding behind that which, you know, you're fearing to let go. So, Michaela, thank you so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me and for taking the time and interest to hear about Coco Schumann and his amazing life story. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. If you'd like to find out more information again about the book that we're talking about, is The Ghetto Swinger, and it is A Life Saved by Music, Legendary Musician's Journey from Nazi Concentration Camps to a Life of Musical Brilliance. Again, it is a story of Coco Schumann. And thank you so much, Michaela Haas, today. And as always, have a wonderful day. And until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit www.drjeanettewellness.com to schedule a phone appointment today with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.